Is there really any neutrality on a college campus where your students are being assaulted? If you're a Jewish student, you represent violence.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guests today are Amitai Nelkin and Sahar Tartak, two student fellows and Fight Hate, an organization that is focused on combating anti-Semitism from progressive organizations. So here I am with Amitai and Sahar. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
This is really nice. And this is actually the first time we have met. And it really is exciting for me because I know a lot about what's happening at Columbia University, and I speak with a lot of the students at Columbia University. I know a lot of what's happening in other universities from professors, from social media, from the news, but it really is so important to have students on the ground coming and saying what your experiences are like. But before we start, there's a question that I ask every guest to begin an episode. I'm going to start with you, Sahar.
Please.
Sahar, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, that's a tough one. Because I don't like the labels, to be honest. A happy Jew.
A happy Jew?
Yeah.
What makes you happy?
Life. It's precious. It's a gift. Your life is a gift.
Wow.
And I feel it every day, and I feel it the most in the worst circumstances.
Because we're going to get to really very bad stuff, and I want to go back to this happy Jew. But before we do, Amitai, what kind of a Jew are you?
I don't think my answer is going to be as poetic, but I am a progressive, Shabbat and Kashrut observant conservative Jew, if I were to use the labels. I would also say I'm a happy Jew most of the time, but that's my Jewish background.
And I think I do want to, you know, some people will be watching this on YouTube, other people are listening on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts and other platforms. So they might not see. So Amitai, you wear a yarmulke, you're a visibly Jewish student. And Sahar, you wear a skirt, you're, you know, especially for people who know what Jewish women look like, you're a visibly Jewish student.
It's no secret. And last semester I was wearing a Magen David necklace, but it broke and I'm still waiting to get it fixed.
Okay, so maybe we can get you one. Here I am, Magen David. So you're both student activists at Fight Hate. Amitai, you're at Brown. Sahar, you're at Yale. What is Fight Hate? Why did you even join this organization?
I can go first on that. So Fight Hate is a organization that is that holds progressive values, although it is non-political. I wouldn't say apolitical, but it exists for the most part outside of that space. And its goal is to combat anti-Semitism and all forms of hate, although right now it's got its hands full with anti-Semitism, on college campuses and on social media. I became involved with the organization over the summer when I worked with them in a wide variety of capacities, helping them with their social media and getting their the first cohort of Fight Hate activists up and running.
So, and Sahar, why did you choose to become a fellow in this organization?
Sure. So when I spoke with Jay, who's founded Fight Hate, I was just inspired by his creativity and positivity. There's clearly a belief here that anybody can join us in a mission for good. But to recruit people on that mission, you have to get creative. So I find it interesting that like we can have a target audience that like views itself as progressive, and we could still say, hey, you can oppose Jew hatred on college campuses, and here's why that's like meaningful to you in a way that it's meaningful to everyone.
So, but here's a question, and it might be a bit of a difficult question, but you know, it's Fight Hate is an organization that's specifically to fight all sorts of hatred, including now focused on anti-Semitism in progressive circles. Shouldn't those be the circles with the least amount of hate? Like, why do we even need to fight hate in progressive circles?
I mean, I'm not going to make any assumptions. I'll chalk it up to an accident. But for some reason, especially, or I'd say something we've seen since October 7th, and I'm not the first to say it, is that the idea of anti-Semitism has hopefully by accident been taken up under the banner of progressive values, along with all the other things that should be celebrated. It's been dragged along for the ride. And with that, we see it, the longer we don't address that, the further, and the longer it gets carried along, the harder it will be to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I also think that there, like in any kind of ideological movement, there is room for things to go deeply wrong if the seeds are already there. And people have spoken about how progressivism had the potential for, you know, labeling Jews as oppressors and doing something like justifying October 7th, which is what we saw on college campuses in the past year. My sense is that it doesn't need to be that way, that there are people out there who view themselves as progressive, call themselves progressive, but they mean that in the sense that they want to help people and they don't want to see violence where violence is unnecessary and unjust. And speaking on those terms, why can't we say that October 7th was wrong? And I think these messages are simple, and I think we just have to get them out there more.
I would say on campus, most people that don't know me but see me would not think I am, and probably have already labeled me as being, I don't know, on the right wing, which is not where I find myself.
So, because progressive in the past year have become a very loaded term, I use to describe my values as on the progressive end. Now, my values have not changed a bit, but the label has changed, so I no longer use that label. But Sahar, do you see yourself as a progressive student, or?
Gosh, I agree that I don't even know what that means anymore. One thing I'll say is that for the past year or so, like as a student on a college campus, I haven't even had the chance to get into the weeds of so many of these questions because I've been a little bit too busy saying, like, Hamas is bad and October 7th was bad. Come on, guys. Hamas is bad and October 7th was bad. Come on, guys. And then I, like Ami, get labeled a right-winger when, I thought it was a simple message that maybe even transcended some of the labels. So if now being a progressive means that, you know, terrorism is progressive, okay, I'm not a progressive.
Yeah. What I would say, I mean, I am an optimist. And what I like to say to people I'm talking to, if I get the opportunity on campus or just in general, is that when we're talking specifically about college campus, I strongly believe that nobody who you're talking to wants more dead children. And so when we
assume nobody wants more dead anyone, right?
Nobody wants more dead anyone. And so when we, or when somebody is making the accusation that the person that you won't speak to, let's say the Zionist in your class, wants dead children, I asked them, like, do you really think that somebody that you share a campus with, or that a large group of people that you share a campus with, actually believes that? Because if we can't get past that point, if that's what people honestly believe, then we don't have the ability to have a dialogue. Now, I don't believe that that's the case. I think that everyone wants the same thing. We have different ideas of how to get there, but that same thing is we want people to have security. We want people to have safety and freedom. And we can disagree about the best way to get there, whether that's one state, two state, whatever. But as long as you cannot allow yourself to fall into the trap of assuming that the person that has a different view than you is evil, that person wants dead anybody. And the problem is, I think that's what we've seen. We've seen utter demonization, you know, and dehumanization of Zionists and of Jews.
So yeah, before we get to the fighting the hate, we need to establish, what is this hate? And again, Amitai, you're at Brown, Sahar, you're at Yale. I haven't been on your campuses in the past 14 months. Well, I've been on both campuses as an academic in the past. Walk me through what is the student life, Jewish student life right now? What is there a lot of hate? Is it rare? Is it frequent? What's going on?
Sure. It's an excellent question. And I think that in answering this, it's worth noting that when I speak with my friends from other campuses, we have consensus over what we're seeing. So unless I say otherwise, like most of these stories are going to apply to a lot of other university campuses, especially in the Ivy League, but maybe also elsewhere. So after October 7th, immediately we saw on the Yale campus and again on a lot of other college campuses, statements coming out of student groups at Yale. It was Yale's for Palestine and so on and so forth. Statements like, we should celebrate the resistance's success. Or at the very least, you know.
The resistance being Hamas.
Correct.
PFLP, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, etc.
Yes. And, you know, maybe a more moderate version of that message was, this is fully Israel's fault, which of course isn't moderate because it absolves Hamas of its atrocities. But regardless, that was kind of what we were seeing coming out of campus. At Yale, again, right after October 7th, we had like things like Free Palestine and Love for Gaza chalked all over campus. And then we had protests that ensued prior to Israel's retaliation in Gaza. So this was like a general sort of celebration and justification of the acts of October 7th. And then we saw this continue through the next year in different forms, and continuing to today. So we had in the spring an encampment at Yale and at a lot of other campuses, which turned violent. We had posters all over the school that accused Jews of being drunk off the blood of the oppressed, so sounding kind of like blood libel, all of these funky accusations that, like Ami said, some of us are, you know, attracted to blood and gore and death, coming from students who, following one of the goriest days in Jewish history, said, this is something we should celebrate. So maybe that kind of helps us understand what we might call the hate on our college campuses. In terms of Jewish life, I think that much good has come of this, which is a shocker, but a lot of Jewish students at Yale have, you know, approached me with like a deep interest in Judaism and a deep pride for standing up and having some courage. A lot feel the opposite. Many students are ashamed. Many students think that they have
ashamed of what?
They're ashamed of their right to life. They think they have something to apologize for, that Israel exists and that Jews live in the land of Israel.
Jewish students.
Correct.
Do you, and again, because you're a junior, so you've been at Yale for a bit now, do you feel that that's new, that that's something that's been building up, or something that they brought from high school, middle school, or really a reaction to everything?
I think it's both. So I think a lot of Jewish students at Yale that I knew already sort of had an underlying sense of shame about being Jewish because of like stereotypes that their friends had about them or about Israel. And I would see it. I would see students say like, oh, you're not going to do this tradition, are you? And my friends say, oh my gosh, no, God forbid that I would keep this like X, Y, or Z Jewish tradition because it's embarrassing, because we're judged and we're judged forever. And there are a lot of students who are Jewish and want to have an identity with people that are judging them. So for instance, you're a Yale student, you're Jewish. You want your identity to be a Yale identity. You want to be defined as a Yale student. You want that to be who you are. What are you going to do when some of that is mutually exclusive with your Jewish identity? What are you going to do when it demands that you make sacrifices that your Jewish grandparents would not have wanted you to make? I think a lot of students make that sacrifice because it's a big burden when they're, again, like young people, we were talking about this earlier before the podcast, people are seeking identity. It's hard to find, and you find it in your friends. And when your friends turn against you, it's going to take a lot to say, no, you don't get to do that. It's going to take much less to say, maybe you're right to turn against me.
Hmm. How about in Brown? At Brown, what has gone on at Brown?
So I would say that the there's been a couple stages to the situation at Brown. Before I get into that, I want to say that Jewish life at Brown is thriving. The attendance at, for example, Hillel dropped, not after October 7th. I would say probably went up immediately after October 7th, after there was a controversy that I'll get into, where students felt that by going to Hillel, they would be perceived as Zionist. There was a drop, but this year it's back and numbers are through the roof and the Jewish community is very strong. At Brown, post October 7th, I would say there is definitely a progression. There was some groups that were, trying to thread the needle, celebrate October 7th, but not be outright in support of Hamas and things like that, or specific actions.
You're too nice. What does it mean? What does it mean to celebrate October 7th but not support Hamas? Are you celebrating?
I agree.
Okay.
You don't have to convince me, but at first there's a huge difference between their most recent, what they will say, the words that they will use, versus what they started with. At the beginning, they tried to be groups like SJP and Associates.
SJP is Students for Justice
in Palestine. And at Brown specifically, there's also the Brown Divest Coalition, which is an umbrella group. And they said that, we mourn loss of life on both sides. This is the reaction of an oppressed, whatever. Horrific statement when you think about it, but equivocating with their words. If you go then to over the summer when they, or early this semester when they post something of Sinwar and of Hania, and there's no hesitation at all.
So there's heads of and designated terrorists.
Yes, and celebrating them. And they posted after Hania was killed a video of him talking about the joys of martyrdom. That's real. And so there's been, number one, a loss of kind of like inhibition. I would say, though, on Brown's campus after October 7th, there was a bit of a quiet period. Then there was it was the trendy thing to do, to be protesting. But I'd say that the real turning point came was that over last Thanksgiving break, three Palestinian students were shot in Vermont. One of which,
in November 2020.
Yes, and one of which was a Brown student.
Which, by the way, I want to hear, but it was reported that case, three Palestinian men were shot in Vermont. It was reported as some sort of Zionist hate crime, where in fact, what the media didn't report was that the guy that shot them, that was mentally unstable, had actually been posting a lot against Jews and against Israel on his social media. But yeah.
It was a horrific act of violence. It was a random act of violence. And
a stupid loss of life.
Luckily they all survived. The worst injured was the student at Brown, who was paralyzed from the, can no longer walk. And that's horrific. And the act of violence is disgusting. And it has no connection to the Jewish students on Brown's campus, because immediately after that, an eruption of what was word for word blood libel, blaming Zionist students, saying that you have blood on your hands.
These three men's blood
on specifically your hands for example. So Brown Students for Israel said, after we do for really any event, we said this is a horrific accident, we pray for his recovery, just as basically every other student group did as well. Because banal and typical statement to say, something that any human would say, is that this was a horrific act. And immediately responses and screenshots and writing over and keep his name out of your expletive mouths and you Zionist pigs, and across the board. It was an eruption.
I think something that basically a pattern that you'll see is that bad things will happen, and Ami and I and Jews on college campuses will be blamed. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we got there because, you know, rest assured that like Ami doesn't have a gun and I don't have access to some of the violence that these students are upset with. But somehow it comes back to us. I think, again, it's this sort of conspiratorial hatred of Jewish people where like we have power and when something happens, we really have to look towards like Brown Hillel or Yale Chabad and trace it back to them. It's very odd. It doesn't make sense. But I think that's what you're describing.
Yeah. And so what happened, as I mentioned a little bit earlier with the Brown Hillel, was that they released a statement addressing one, like an internal statement, just to the Jewish student listserv, an email saying a horrific crime occurred over Thanksgiving break. Also, we have seen a horrific explosion of anti-Semitism and blood libel in a response, and we stand with you, students, and we pray for the recovery of the student. And somebody shared that email. It got out. It wasn't a secret. And then from that point on, absolute demonization of Hillel, and that's when people stopped attending.
It's not everyone listening would know what Hillel is. So how would you explain the role of Hillel clubs?
It is crucial. Hillel is a organization that gives that provides space and resources for Jewish life on campus. Even the groups that are anti-Hillel on Brown's campus, at least, still rely on Hillel as a lifeline. And they still provide Siddurim, prayer books, and any other ritual objects that they need because that's what they're there to do. But from that point on, after that horrific violence over Thanksgiving, from that point on Brown's campus, you were either anti-Zionist or you were the other. You know, it was no longer a discussion.
I want to get to the point of how we got to this, but Sahar, you also personally experienced violence on Yale's campus. What happened?
Yeah. So we saw a slow buildup on the Yale campus of the same students that had called October 7th a success slowly occupy and escalate and take over our university. And as this sort of grew, when I would speak to administrators, they would tell me, well, we don't want to shut them down because we don't want to escalate them. So instead, they escalated on their own, and, you know, we're talking
this,
about...
This is... If, I know my immediate reaction was to smile and laugh because, you know, it doesn't work this way. Right. Like, when someone hates, they will hate. They won't hate conditionally of you doing something. They will hate. It'll just... The pace of escalation might matter, but nothing else. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was... And this escalation argument was made to me by a top administrator at the university. And I warned them, I'm just waiting for a Jew to get assaulted. And so finally they set up a tent encampment on campus, which, you know, I assume people are familiar with by now. They occupied basically the main quad on campus. They had like a shrine to Waleed Daka, who's this terrorist that mutilated an Israeli Jew, and people were like dropping off flowers at this guy's shrine just to kind of give you an idea of what the imagery was here. Like Ami said, it's also very bloody. You have calls of from the river to the sea, Palestine will be Arab. You know, this is openly genocidal and it has been from the start. And so one evening I made the mistake after Shabbat of going to one of these rallies with a Jewish friend of mine who wears a black hat and recording it. And upon arrival, my friend Netanel, he and I were mobbed and blockaded by a group of masked students. I think they were students. It's hard to tell with the masks. And the method...
That's the whole point of the mask.
Correct. And the method is like this. They wear yellow vests and they say, "We are protest marshals. And it is our job to keep everybody safe."
Yes.
So, but on whose behalf?
Ambiguous.
Because the SA also started as protest marshals for the Nazis.
Right.
They were walking around with banners on their hands, at first we didn't even have swastikas on them. So we are just here to keep the
keep
peace.
The peace.
I want to say we also have the of yellow course. Vest exactly the same. It's very homogenous intercampus.
Officially, I think they're involved. Yeah, I think they're Yellies for Palestine, right? So they're part of that club. They're
so not on behalf of the university.
Oh, no.
Not on behalf of any police force. They have made themselves the paramilitary force to keep the peace.
And their slogan last semester was, "We keep us safe." So, okay, so you can keep you guys safe. How will you do that? Supposedly.
So wait, are you not part of us?
Exactly.
I was also
blocked.
The
method is, you keep us safe. We keep us safe. We keep, you know, ourselves safe. By creating an environment that's dangerous for Jewish students. And that's genius, because what does it teach? It teaches you that if you're a Jewish student, you represent violence, you represent danger, and we're going to do whatever we need to do to kick you out by all means necessary, because you love the death of children, you drink the blood of the oppressed, and you represent all that is evil in this world. So then what is going to happen to you when you show up to a rally to record, even if you're not counter-protesting, which of course I wasn't?
By the way,
please
let me play devil's advocate,
please,
or Sinwar's advocate. why are you recording? Why, we're having a rally. Why are you walking around recording people?
That's an easy question. Because you have seen what has happened, either yourself or with your friends, or online for somebody else that recorded. You know that this is a dangerous environment. You know that the safety force involved is not such a thing, and you know that the administration does not want to get involved, and you know that if something happens, which it often does, no one's going to believe you. It will be your word against theirs, and the moment that there is some type of uncertainty as to what happened, it will be dropped, because it will be inconclusive. At Brown specifically, the Department of Education closed their investigation over the summer with a settlement. But what they had found was that what we had all known, that the administration's loyalty and the systems that they had set up was to not helping pro-Israel students, not helping pro-Palestine students, but to doing nothing. Of all the something in the hundreds, I believe, number of cases opened, none of them were closed. But they'd been stopped because they had been driven, they had been slowed down to the point of ending. There was nowhere further to go, and there was no justice. There was no reconciliation. It just ended.
That's brilliant. I think Columbia University falls under the same thing. I would even change Columbia's motto to loyalty to indifference. That's their loyalty. So Sahar, back to, you're there. They are surrounding you or barricading you?
Both. How's this? So initially, it's me and my friend, and they mob you, and they link arms and they stand in front of you so you can't walk forward, right? So they...
Where is this space? Like,
this is the quad on campus.
So this is public space.
Correct. Oh, you have a legal right to walk around the quad on campus.
You've actually paid, your parents have paid tens of thousands of dollars so you can walk
around. In addition to my poor parents and their pockets. And you are standing in front of a line of students, and a long one at that, that is simply not letting you walk around. And when you do, they're following you. So there's videos of this, on my Twitter, of me and my friend Netanel trying to kind of navigate our own university campus as Jewish students and being blocked. And eventually, Netanel and I were encircled, and they took a boombox and they put it next to Netanel, and they started playing music whose lyrics were so expletive about Israel that I won't exactly repeat them, but it was things like, "Y'all just want the profits. Ah, Jews want money." Ah, and then they said, okay. And then they looked at each other and they said, maybe this is a bad idea. And they switched the song to Arab rap music. And if we translate the Arabic rap music, it was fully about like women in body bags and acts of violence. So Netanel and I are there with this boombox blasting anti-Semitic music at us about like death. And we get split up. And so then we each have our own kind of mobs following us. And I find myself cornered.
How did you feel?
My heart's racing. I mean, this is nerve-wracking. Every person in the crowd, and we're talking hundreds of students, thinks that you are worthy of what happens to your cousins on October 7th. And so why wouldn't they act on it? Someone is bound to act on it. And they're anonymized. So no one knows who you are. There's no accountability, and all of this is on purpose. The idea that I think is really important here is the environment is curated for violence and danger. It's not a side effect. It's the goal. You're being followed by 5, 10, 15 hostile people standing in front of you in a line who again believe that you are worthy of death. And not only is it you being followed by them, but eventually you're surrounded by the entire rally. And then it's me, and there are 500 people walking around me in a circle. And besides that, there's also the human blockade that was set up from the beginning. So as they're taunting me, not just the official, you know, marshals with the yellow jackets, but also just the students
unofficial
attending, also just the students attending the rally, they're waving things in my face, the middle finger, the keffiyeh, and eventually somebody jabs my left eye with the Palestinian flag, and I try to run after him, and the mob protects him. Why do they protect him? Because he was doing their dirty work. He was doing his job. And so I went and I spoke to one of the protest marshals. And again, there's a video of this online. And I told her, I want to get this violent person out of your rally. And her response to me was, I really want to understand your intention here. Like, what do you want to get out of this? Excuse me, ma'am. I want to get the guy that just assaulted a sensitive body part out of your rally. Don't you want him out of the rally? Yes, but I have to ask you a couple more questions. Ah, so now we're stalling. Okay, so now we know what the protest marshals are like, but they're not important because we already understood. Let's talk about the university. I spoke to university police.
Wait, before we get to that.
Please.
That's exactly what I want to ask. Where are the administrators? Where are the professors? And where is public safety?
So I much less, you know, violent in interaction, fortunately, but I also was outside a rally on the public green, which is my right, you know, and similarly, students calling themselves marshals with the yellow vests blockaded me as I was trying to see what was happening, as well as film what was happening, because I'm aware of the danger that can occur, and again, both of which are my right to exist on the green. And I would walk, and they would step in front of me. And I would walk, and they would step in front of me. And I would say, can you please get out of my way? And they wouldn't say anything. So I would keep walking. And they said to me, you're in my personal space. And I'm like, I would sure like to not be. Can I please go through? Oy. And then they would say nothing. And so I would walk again. They would say, I'm in your space. I'm like, I'm sorry to hear that. Why don't I walk this way? You walk that way. And, you know, they would just stay in my way. They would block me from walking. So I went over to a public safety officer that was there. And I said, because before I went over, I said, hey, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to go over to the public safety officer. If you don't stop, they didn't stop. So I went. And I said to the public safety officer, I said, hopefully now that they see me talking to you, they won't do it again. But I just wanted to let you know, I was trying to.
So the public safety officer was there.
Was there.
So they could see.
They could see.
They are paid by Brown.
And so, and with them as well was a student activities office administrator.
So they're observing.
Observing, yes. A
threatening of a visibly Jewish student on Brown's campus.
And so I go up to them and I say, so I'm telling you, you could probably see, but I'll tell you what happened. I was trying to walk in a straight line. I said, I'm not even trying to get through. I'm not even trying to get to the front. I'm just trying to get near because I want to see.
You have any
and also right if I want to be in the front, exactly.
I'm sorry, you guys are very, your parents raised you well. I'm going to be the one. You have every fucking right to be in the center wherever you want because that's public space. And because you are there just like any other student.
I completely agree. But I didn't want to push it because I was.
You're a nice kid.
Well, I tried it lightly. I said, I just want to get near because now I'm far, and I want to see what's happening. So I say, I'm going to walk again in a straight line. And I hope, I mean, I'm like, so sounds good. And just in case something happens, I want to let you know. And they say, no, that's not okay. Our job is to keep you safe. So they said, our job is to keep you safe. And we don't think it'd be safe for you to do that. And I said, I was taken aback by that. I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, we're trying to stop, you know, from there being any like commotion or any escalation. And so we're going to say, hey, you should stay out of there. And I'm like, what do I say to that?
So
I just wanted to walk near, and they said,
a Jew being blocked from a public space in campus is not commotion. A Jew trying to go wherever they want on campus is commotion.
We're much safer in the ghetto. Like, that's basically the message, is stay away and you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But we don't want to stay away. We want to go to our universities.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, and there's nothing much else to it. And this was at one rally, and then you can imagine a similar situation with the encampment. And when they occupied a building, which they actually did before the encampment, it was a separate situation. But the curation of a number one majority, a Jewish free space, definitely an Israeli free space, but a space in the most general sense, free of different ideas. And they would maintain it their way. They would keep themselves safe and unopposed ideologically. And anyone that went in would be harassed.
Emotionally safe.
Yeah. So, and all of this is protected by, there's no other way than saying this, a paramilitary marshals.
It is, I would say that it, I,
yeah, exactly.
It is, I've referred to it that way, and it is,
there's
fascinating.
No difference in that and Proud Boys.
I agree with you.
It is, they called us Proud Boys at
well,
their first rally.
Jews,
they got confused.
So I want to ask, and this is a two-part, so I'm going to ask Sahar the first part and then Amitai the second part. Sahar, how did we get to the point where students that apparently did very well in high school could get into Yale, Brown, Columbia, Harvard, UPenn, Stanford, Berkeley, I can keep going, to the point where they praise an arch-terrorist like Yahya Sinwar, where they block Jews from going on campus, where they walk around massing keffiyehs and, you know, jabbing you in the eye. How did we get to that point?
Well, I think, so one of the best things I've learned in my classes at Yale is a quote like this from a professor of mine's book, Professor Gaddis. And it says,
I'm glad there's still professors writing good things, and I'm glad there's students that are listening and reading. But yeah.
Thank God, we're very lucky. So common sense is like oxygen. The higher up you go, the less there is. And at our universities, you can have a discussion on a very high level with an academic who has a great vocabulary. And you can either talk about nothing, or you could talk about that something, and the something that you talk about is the justification of October 7th. If you're really, really, really smart, you can get so into the weeds, you can dig so deep into the oppression of the Palestinian people that amputating a mother in front of her children is warranted. It's the natural way of things. What else happens to oppressed people? They've dug into an ideology, and I think this is the confusion, right? Is that we sometimes confuse like intellect for morality. These are not the same thing. I know kids who are really, really, really smart. That doesn't mean that they're not capable of what you and I can comfortably call evil. You know, it's the most obvious stuff, the most intuitive knowledge that a great intellect can actually sweep away. And we've seen this before. It's happened in history. It happens again. People believe in crazy things all the time, and their leaders are the smartest ones of them all.
There's a quote, I'm butchering it, but by George Orwell, and it goes something like, some ideas are so stupid that only intellectual people can believe them.
Yeah, and I think it's also a matter of weak leadership that at the university level, our administrators were intimidated and bullied by a mob that's quite similar to the one that we saw after October 7th into teaching students bad ideology, into teaching them to believe things that were counterintuitive and also false, and that you could have already had in a university course lessons that, like, if you had been in the class long enough and you had listened closely and you realize, oh, my professor doesn't believe in free will. Oh, my professor thinks in an oppressor-oppressed dichotomy. Then why wouldn't your class also lead you to believe that October 7th was an act of justified resistance? The infrastructure was already there, and it was up to university leaders, not administrators, leaders, to say, none of this, no more.
Which brings me to the second part, and that's for Amitai. So, Sahar, you really described one aspect of how 20-year-old Americans can become enamored with a U.S.-designated terrorist organization or multiple U.S.-designated terrorist organizations while they are keeping American citizens hostages. The question to you, Amitai, is how did Brown leadership, Yale leadership, Columbia leadership, Harvard leadership, MIT leadership, how did they let this get to this point?
So what we learned very quickly after October 7th is that at Brown, there were essentially no mechanisms in place or no systems that had the ability to hold a group accountable. That really didn't exist. We went after some horrific things were posted after October 7th. And we went to the student activities office and we said, what are the student conduct rules for a club? And we were told that there are none. Now we heard from other administrators when we were shocked by that response. And they said, oh, no, they must be confused. That's obviously not the case. Of course, there are rules for a club. But they're not specific. And the person that we spoke to that said there are no rules for the club is the one in charge of student clubs.
Wait, but I don't understand this. You know, the way we operate in society in at large, but also in smaller organizations, is you have the formal explicit rules, and then you have the informal implicit norms, etc. I think we all know that if a club excluded a student of color, even if there are no formal rules, something would happen. Something. I don't know what, but something would happen. I think we know that if a club posted on social media a racial slur, something must happen. Like, there's, same with LGBTQ issues, and as they should. Like, if something sexist was posted, so that's back to the common sense. Where is the common sense there?
So,
or common morality, yeah. I would say.
So since there are no systems, and I completely agree with you that in those cases when, as you said, something absolutely should be done, I would hope something would be done. And I think it would. But it doesn't have to be done. The university, there's no, there's nothing to keep, to bring you to that point except for common sense. And an additional factor that the university, for right or for wrong, I have my own opinions, weighs very equally, is like you said, dedication to indifference or to keeping a low profile. It was already a difficult time for a university. Obviously a difficult time for a Jewish student on a university campus. It was a difficult time for a university. They didn't want to be called into Congress. They didn't want to be written up in the newspaper. They want to keep having people apply to their school. They didn't want to have a scandal. And so, as across the United States, the bar kept being raised, or the envelope kept being pushed for what you could allow on campus. If there was an encampment on October 8th,
the bar kept being lowered.
Or lowered, I guess. Yes. Yeah. If there was an encampment on October 8th, That would not last for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, five. I would say, well, what president, because then that kicks into the common sense and saying, this is not something I can let on my campus. But as it's a slow build, and as it's a build that for the most part didn't affect you being an administrator that's not Jewish or doesn't have a connection to Israel or to Jewish life, you see it as, okay, there's some type of thing, I don't fully understand it. And so I'm just going to say, let's keep things quiet. I think back to how students got to this point and how universities got to this point is it's easier to see something horrific in the world, like October 7th. So a horrific, like disgusting, unexplainable event of just, there's no words for it. It's an event you can't describe, and it's easier to say, well, it's complicated, because saying it's complicated is a simple thing to say. It's saying, I don't have to understand it. And for some students, that means maybe it goes into the dichotomy of, you know, this is oppressed versus oppressed. And for an administrator, it's saying, this is a conflict like any other conflict. And what we do is we don't get involved.
But but to be fair, I don't think a Brown administrator needs to get involved in the Gaza,
of course,
Hamas, Israel war. We're not talking about that. We're talking about
how it plays out on
Jewish
campus.
Student, yeah. An American citizen, Jewish students on the green at Brown not being able to walk freely. That is something that they must get involved, not just can get involved.
I would say so too. But there's a lot of different departments at Brown, a lot of different accountability departments. And so in a way, none of them have to pick up the job because another one might.
Where are the professors in all of this? Where are your professors? And I'm not talking about the professors, like, I don't know if you had them at Brown and Yale. We had our version of the Brown shirts, the yellow vests. They had orange vests that showed that they are faculty that are supporting Hamas. But where are the professors in your campuses seeing all of this?
So absolutely, we have that type that doesn't like Jews and likes Hamas. We have a number of professors on campus that are, first of all, quietly fighting in their respective departments against the professorial equivalent of what happens on our campus. And I speak to them frequently, but they haven't put those fights in the news, but they exist.
So you've qualified it with quietly.
Yes, totally.
Does that bug you that it's quiet?
I think all of this should be out in the open. I think there's a rot and people need to see it. But in fairness, I'm not a professor and I'm not on the inside, at least not on the faculty. So if you're a professor and you're threatening the university intelligently and saying, I'm keeping this quiet for now, but if this fails, I'm going to blow you up, then I respect it. Yeah, that could be what's happening. And I suspect that for a number of professors that is what's happening. But then we have here and there a professor who's outspoken or willing to be outspoken. So like at Yale, Professor Stephen Smith went viral for waving the flag, the Israeli flag, at graduation while students were protesting against Israel at graduation. But I definitely don't think it's good enough. I love my professors and I love the professors that are on my side and agree with me and provide with me with support. But I wish it could be a little bit more open and public.
And what about the non-Jewish professors or even the Jewish professors who are not doing anything? Where are they?
So again, it's a combination. I think you have the same sense that the administrators have, which is, oh gosh, I really don't want to rock the boat here. And I don't want to have to do with any of this. And it says, you don't want to have to do with any of this, but this has a lot to do with you. This is your institution. You have a responsibility to exhibit moral clarity. And that's my sense. And I think is many of our professors, right? So of course you have those that lie on the side against Israel and you have those that lie, you know, on the side for Israel and they fight in their ways. But then I think the middle might actually be the biggest. I want nothing to do with this.
There are incredible professors at Brown, and most of the professors I've had at my time there, I hold in very high regard. And I would say that what the situation really is that you have professors that are pro-Palestine or in support of the student action. And so they will sign a list and they will be public about it and they will say their names. And then the professors that are that are sympathetic towards or see what's happening to like Jewish students or Israeli students on campus, they will provide that support. And if there's some type of harassment, they will help the student. They will help them if they've fallen behind on their work. But from the same place as a principled stance of saying, I don't want to see my students harassed, I also know that I don't want another student to feel uncomfortable in my class. I am a professor, and unless I'm a professor of the modern Middle East, if I'm a biology professor or if I'm a physics professor, I shouldn't bring that into my classroom. I'll support the student. The only issue is, and I think that that's a very logical, like you said, professors do not need to be involved in the conflict. So there are professors that see what's happening, hold their own views, don't want to bring it up, but will support a student. The problem is that there's also other professors who see what's happening and don't care about supporting their students, professors that want to make noise. So if you're looking at it, you see a loud and a quiet, and the quiet is very much still there, and it is crucial support. And I'm not even saying that they should do anything different, but it does give you a skewed sense when you're looking at the faculty, and you can feel when you look at these long lists of names of people that have signed onto some letter, supporting the encampment or supporting whatever, you're like, who else is there? Because you don't see a list with the opposite, because those professors want to support, the best professors want to support all their students. And so they don't put their name on a list.
To be maybe a little bit more pessimistic or cynical, and maybe I'm older, maybe it's because I'm a professor, maybe it's because I was a born Eeyore. I don't think it's a skewed sense. I think, yes, the silent majority is there.
I wouldn't call it
But even if it were a silent majority, a sizable silent group is there, but a sizable silent group was also there in Nazi Germany. So at some point, if you're silent, then you're not there.
I agree. And I think at this point, like, is there really any neutrality on a college campus where your students are being assaulted? Like, doesn't even like the physics professor have a responsibility to say, I don't like seeing my students get assaulted? But I also think this reveals a pattern, and we've seen it in Jewish students too, and I kind of mentioned it earlier, which is that when it comes to the people who actually believe what we might call the kind of normal right things, that October 7th was bad, and that Hamas is bad, and that we don't like when people kill each other unjustly, they're actually the people who are the most ashamed and embarrassed and uncomfortable to speak out on it. Whereas if you are the face of evil on a college campus, we have a professor, Zarina Grewal, who on like October 7th or 8th posted like, today is an exhilarating day on Twitter. And it's like, okay, why is she so proud and we're not? And that, I think, is another side of this, which is that you have so many people who don't think October 7th was an exhilarating day, and they won't say it because they feel some sense of shame and being on the right side.
My question is, why is a professor like that still hired by a university that's federally funded?
Which one? The quiet one?
The October 7th was exhilarating.
Oh.
That's, you know, it's interesting. You talk about neutrality, and for me, something that just fighting this fight, you have so many mind-boggling experiences. I was in Boston to speak at a Jewish high school, and there was another high school that I was supposed to go to, which is a public high school, invited by the Jewish Students Union or organization to speak about anti-Semitism. And I was really excited because it was the first time that I was going to be speaking at a public high school and there will be non-Jews there. And I just wanted to come and talk about anti-Semitism as another sort of hatred and what can we do about it. The last moment, the high school canceled my event. And what did they tell the students? we can't have him if we don't have someone on the other side because of neutrality. And the students were brilliant. They said, you mean you want us to bring a pro-anti-Semitism person? Is that the other side that you... Like, if you came, if you brought someone who is anti-racist, do we need to balance them out with a racist?
Exactly.
If we brought in a feminist, do we need to then balance it with a sexist or with a rapist? Like, how does this neutrality thing work?
I love this subject, and I wrote about it with a friend in the Wall Street Journal at the beginning of the school year, because it comes out often even more subtly on the university campus, where after October 7th, all of Yale's statements, at least by my count, referred to anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Even though we saw nothing of the sort happening to Muslim students on our campus. And take it a step further, that Yale actually provided more funding for instance, Middle Eastern and North African Students Association, which was supposed to include Israelis, because I think Israel's in the Middle East.
Last I checked.
But, like, ultimately did not, and was, in the end, dominated by students, the same students, right, who had been calling October 7th an act of justified resistance. So it's fascinating, because October 7th happens, and, you know, it's, like, kind of just this open targeting of Jewish people and this open celebration of Jewish death. And the university responds by saying, well, you know, we're very concerned about the people on the side of October 7th and the people on the side of Hamas, and we're very worried about them. But we're going to veil it, and we're going to say we're generally worried about Islamophobia and anti-Arab racism, when that's not really much of an issue at the Yale campus, right? Like, you can't point to the same number or the same extent of incidents at Yale, like, as has happened to Jewish students in real life. So it's not grounded in reality. And it does more than that. It kind of, like, subverts the truth. So
I think there's, and we should be honest about, like, there is Islamophobia. It is a problem, a relatively large problem in the United States, especially it was the post 9/11. But I agree with you completely. When Islamophobia is 10 times larger than anti-Semitism, you need to focus more on Islamophobia. But right now, when anti-Semitism is, you know, the pressing concern, 10 times, 15 times more, you shouldn't be equating. You don't go into your doctor says, what's wrong? You say, well, I'm having a heart attack and I think I have a cavity. Right? Both things are true and both things are painful. One of those things requires your immediate attention because it's 10, 15, 20 times more problematic at that specific moment.
I would say it's a disservice to both Jewish and Muslim students entirely to lump it together. In instances of Islamophobia, you don't want an email going out saying Islamophobia and anti-Semitism. Also, it's not good to pose them as you know, one opposes the other. It's not like these are the two... These are two halves these are the two opposite ideas. Either you're anti-Jewish or anti-Muslim. You're contributing to the problem right there. And when our student body president was in an interview for our newspaper, was asked what she would do about concerns of anti-Semitism, she said, I want to make sure that those are heard in the same volume as those of Islamophobia. I'm like, that's not what you want to do. You want to have them heard in the same volume of their occurrence. Exactly.
That's a very, very good point. But we are not defined by the hate we experience. We are defined by us and by our fight. So what do you do at Fight Hate?
You want to take that or should I?
You first.
Okay. The Fight Hate, in a general sense, is exactly what it sounds like. It seeks to, because where we're at right now is not a place that makes sense. You know? What we're seeing on campus is not something that makes sense. And it comes from a place of, I'd have to hope, ignorance. So that's one piece of Fight Hate. Fight Hate seeks to promote, to share, like, the truth, to share knowledge and information and give...
What the university was supposed to do...
To supplement. To share...
You're too nice. You're picking up Brown's slack because they won't educate students what terrorism is, what Jewish life is, then you're picking up for slack. But that's, you're being nice since you're saying compliment.
So Fight Hate provides, yeah, it provides information about what's going on in the world in Israel and what happened October 7th and all these things. It also seeks to build and to rebuild the connections that were severed. Many Jewish students and Jewish organizations, because of the hostile climate that was and continues to be experienced on many college campuses, kind of retreated into their own, entirely understandably. It was what we had to do because nobody would associate with the Jewish students, with the Zionist students, with the Israeli students, or any organizations. And so, but that's not a place that we want to exist, because we go to the universities that we go to be at the universities, not to spend all our time in Hillel. So Fight Hate, a major component of Fight Hate and their plan going forward is to rebuild these connections and establish new ones so that because no other organization should have a problem having a connection to the Jewish student organization. The engineering department of undergraduate or undergraduate student group, let's have a Hillel connection. Let's have some type of organization. If you have a cooking club, let's have a Jewish event. Have joint events, foster joint connections, and don't have it be a separation into ideological pockets. And the connections for the most important thing, I would say, because when the universities, from what I've seen, ever try to form these connections, when they try to do it, they try and do it about, let's talk about the issue. That's important. But the point is, we exist on a campus together, and we have to be able to exist first. So have people exist in the same space. Have people do a cooking club. Have people talk about engineering, and not be, I am going to avoid that Zionist student. I'm going to avoid that pro-Palestinian student. We have to be able to exist in the same space. From that, you can make mutual understanding, or at the very least, mutual coexistence, which was shattered on October 7th.
It's interesting how coexistence has become a radical perspective.
Ideological coexistence and all types. When you have the encampments and you retreat into a space.
Sahara, how do you build those bridges?
Sure. So I think at the beginning of our conversation, we spoke about the label that we called progressive and what that might mean. And I certainly try to adhere to the Jewish tradition. And I actually think that students, if they were more curious, could do some learning and could be exposed to a Jewish tradition that's more progressive and forward-thinking than anything they've ever seen. And that doesn't have anything to do right now with the Israel-Hamas war. Really, all I've been saying on campus for the past year as a proud Jewish student has been that, like, I didn't like October 7th. I don't like Hamas. And Israel has, you know, a right to defend itself justly. Okay. So I've been saying that, you know, and I'm happy to say those things. I've never given like a full defense of Israel's war after October 7th.
Should you. You're a Jewish American student.
I don't speak for anyone, but regardless, what has happened is this politicization of all things Jewish when we've only been giving these pretty simple apolitical messages. So why not make friends with other students and make them realize what we are as Jews and what Judaism teaches us about our life and about our values? I mean, how much could a Shabbat dinner like benefit every student on a college campus, right? Not using your phone for a couple hours, sitting at a dinner table and looking at someone in their eyes and having a conversation.
You know, I had an incredible experience that was last semester in the spring, after all these encampments and all this absolute chaos, where I was going to play soccer, like kick a soccer ball around with some friends on the green, and it was kind of a Yom HaAtzmaut event, but not really Israel Independence Day. And a non-Jewish friend, saw that I was carrying a soccer ball, and said, "Hey, can I like come play soccer with you guys?" I said, "Sure." And then I was walking, I'm like, "I want to tell you in advance, it's a Yom HaAtzmaut event. So, you know, like Israel Independence Day." He's like, "Okay, I don't care. I just want to play soccer." That is the perfect response. That's where we need to be. And that's where we should be. I don't care that it's Jewish or Israeli or whatever. I want to play soccer. That's all we need.
That is beautiful. That is how ideally we should all be fighting hate. What are the obstacles, if any, that you've been experiencing trying to build these bridges?
I think it's the sense of fear that if we have anything to do with Jews who are like red hot politically on campus now, because, you know, anything like, again, anything Jewish is just assumed to be like I said earlier, like a full defense of Israel, Israeli history, Israel's actions following the attacks of October 7th. Like, all these things got kind of laid onto us, labels that we haven't really asked for. And that's a huge obstacle, because what does that mean? That means that you get students that are extremely reluctant to attend a Shabbat dinner because they think it has political implications. I can assure you that our campus Chabad house does not have very much politics to it. I speak to the rabbi frequently. He is not so political. However, have we been politicized? Of course. Of course. And that, I think, is something that really gets in our way. But what's the best way to kind of dispel that impression? Have a student come around. Look at what we're doing here this evening. Ah, we're making kiddush. We're sanctifying the evening over a glass of wine. Ah, we're saying a prayer on the bread. We're exhibiting gratitude. We're talking to God. Simple, apolitical, human.
By the way, I would love to get invited to a Muslim student club dinner, Christian club dinner, Buddhist club dinner. Like, I like food. And I like people, and I just want to build that connection. It shouldn't be that difficult, especially on college campuses. I could go on and on with the two of you. I just met you today, but this is your delight. I love it. But we do have to look at the time, and I'm going to end the episode like I end every time with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round. It's a series of rapid-fire questions. There are no right or wrong answers. Just come say the first thing that comes to mind. We'll start with you, Sahar, and then Amitai. Sahar, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Ooh. Can do some good accents. Yeah, like Lilo and Stitch.
Wait, what? What else?
Oh, I can sound like my mother when she talks about me. Sad, I'm very stressed out about you. There's so much anti-Semitism at Yale. What is going on? My brother's better than me. You know this.
Amitai, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Let's see. I was born in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Yeah. Exactly.
Sahar, what is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
How much they've learned from us.
Mm-hmm. People don't know how much they've learned from us. Let me tell you.
That there's a Jewish form of everything. There's a Jewish language, a Jewish number system, Jewish math, Jewish units of measurement, Jewish calendar. Because it's a...
Purim is a Jewish Halloween.
Yeah. Well, they know that.
Halloween is a Jewish Purim. Yeah. I mean, a non-Jewish Purim.
Sahar, what is your favorite curse?
Mm-mm. Out of the cards.
There's a, let's see. There's a good Yiddish one I heard of. It's like, may you stick in the, may your head be like planted in the ground and you grow up like a turnip.
See, neither of those are really bad words.
I love it. No, I love it. I love it. What my favorite Yiddish curse is, I don't know how to say it in Yiddish, but may you lose all your teeth but one so you can still experience toothache. Sahar, when was the last time you cried?
Oh, I was watching a beautiful video yesterday. It was a bunch of new Olim, immigrants to Israel, who had just completed, I believe it was their army, like, service training, and they were singing.
My brother just had his bar mitzvah. It was beautiful.
You cried at your brother's bar mitzvah?
At the montage.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That is special.
It's precious.
Zahar, if you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Abe Lincoln?
Let's have a joint Shabbat dinner.
Okay, if you're inviting Abe Lincoln, okay, that's a, Who would pair well with Abe Lincoln?
No, who would you want?
Oh, who would I want? Okay, for Shabbat dinner. You know what? I'd go with like a, what's his name? The guy from, the Maharal of Prague. Because I just, with the golem, you know? Yeah. Maybe he'll bring a friend.
Wow.
You know?
Wow. Abe Lincoln, the Maharal.
Yeah, both tall hats, you know?
Yeah. Sahar, what's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
Mine's Pesach. Why?
I like Fish Amda.
Really?
Yeah.
I like getting with all my family, but I also like matzah and cream cheese.
Ooh.
Matzah and cream cheese is so good.
I like the Fish Amda. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
It's a good one.
Sing it all the time, very loudly in my apartment.
With every generation, they came to destroy us. What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Oof. Rosh Hashanah was long this year. It was just like rough. Too long.
I would say Shemini Atzeret. I don't understand it. It's the eighth day of a seven-day holiday.
When do you feel safest?
When I pray.
Shabbat. Either with my family or on campus. Just the part of Shabbat where you're just hanging out and just relaxing.
When do you feel least safe?
Oy. Sometimes at school.
Where I get the text in the group chat saying there's something happening on the green.
What gives you hope?
Jews that are younger than me.
Campus this semester has been, in the second half, has been so much nicer than it was last year. And I feel like there is healing happening.
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
I still like MLK.
You said Jewish civil rights? Yeah. I think it's something that I feel like we should have figured out by now.
Word.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Chabad at Yale.
I would say Chai Lifeline.
Chai Lifeline?
Yes, it's an organization for Jewish kids with special needs.
All right, so Chabad at Yale and Chai Lifeline, organization for Jewish children with special needs. Sahar, where can people find you?
On Twitter, Sahar_Tartak.
Can you spell it for people?
Of course. SAHAR_TARTAK.
I'm a little hard to find online, but if you stop by Brown, I'll be happy to have you for a Shabbat.
I love it. Well, you too give me hope. Because if you can experience all that you're experiencing and still be hopeful with this huge smile on your faces and still call yourself a progressive, which some audience might not agree with, but the fact that you're able to call yourself that despite all of this and fight to reclaim the label that you want is nothing short of incredible. I am so thankful for you for being here, and I am just delighted to see what you will be doing with your lives. And here I am with Amitai Nelkin and Sahar Tartak.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."